Welcome to the Yeshiva Shalmaila. This is David Lichtenstein. This week, we'll be guest hosted by Rabbi Yeshua Pfeffer. He's a unique individual. Rabbi Yeshua is both from the Beis Din of Rabbi Asher Weiss. He's the editor of a famous journal, Eretz Yisrael, the head of Tikva, Rashiva, and Chedvas HaTorah, Mechabes Sfarim. He's also an attorney. He's really a archivir, trerachshi, a very worldly person to talk about a worldly event, the Israel United Arab Emirates Peace Accord. The United Arab Emirates is seven small little countries, basically little pieces of land floating on an Ukainis, seas of oil, unimaginable wealth, right? But they play a very important part in the part of the Arab world not contiguous to Eretz Yisrael, that, you know, Saudi Arabia, Iraq, that is so important to Eretz Yisrael. And the question is, what is the Torah approach to peace treaties with the Arabs? You know, what sovereignty they had to make concessions about, you know, settlements, etc. Are they allowed to do it? Halacha, hashkafa. And he brought in like a group of very worldly people to speak about it. Rabbi Yitzchak Adlerstein, who's a big Ben Torah. He's also, he wrote Sfarim on the Maral, the Slonim Rebbe. He's also the director for the Simon Wiesenthal Center of Interfaith Affairs. He has a blog, a wonderful blog called Cross Currents. He has Rabbi Stephen Przanski, one of the largest shuls in America, B'nai Yeshurin of Teaneck, a very controversial, famous rabbi, Republican, very pro-Republican. And he has David M. Weinberg, vice president of the Jerusalem Institute for Strategy, diplomatic columnist for the Jerusalem Post. So really has a group of people who are both Torah, but they're also in the world, so fast should be fascinating program. Before we go to our guest host, I want to say a thought. It was just Rish Chodesh El, we're now in the month of El. And Elul, what happened on El? Moshe was Alisa Lamorim, Shavisa Shevi, he went back up to the mount, went back to for 40 days. He went up in El, came down in Yom Kippur. When he came down with the Luchay Shniyas, that say Salachti Kidvarecha, all of El, he was in heaven. So the Megala Mukais, the famous Kabbalist, he lived at the end of the 1500s, lived in Krakow. The Rebbe, so many of his, you know, the later Gedolim were his Talmidim. He says something very mystical. He says that El makes, fittingly, The Oisius, the acronym of El was Orein Luchais Veshivrei Luchais. Aleph Lamed Vav Lamed. Orein Luchais Veshivrei Luchais is Oisius of El. What does he mean to say? I mean, if we could understand him. El is the end of the year. The Torah calls El Achris Shana. And at the end of the year, you know, there's a lot of Shivrei Luchais. What does Shivrei Luchais mean? Moshe went up the first time, and he got the luchos that were written, be'etzpa lekim, they were written by Kaviyachal, not by man. Second luchos were written by Moshe, psalacha. And they were shattered. Shattered dreams. It's the end of the year. I know we're looking forward to a wonderful year. Tachal shanu b'rchaseh. But it's the end of the end. There's a lot of shattered dreams. What is a shattered dream? Could be, look, how much of the United States today is unemployed, of the world. Business destruction. It could be anxiety, depression, shidduchim. How many shidduchim? You know, shidduchim, that divorce. You know, shivrei luchais, all the tzaras we have, fathers, children, mothers, health, chaman olitzvan. So it's a time of shivrei luchais. He says, munachim ba'aren. Luchais, v'shivrei luchais, munachim ba'aren. He said, that's El. You know, there's not a dissimilar thought from the Bal Yitav Lev. It says, Eretz Hashe'eni Hashem Alekechaba, Mireishis Hashana, Ren Shom keeps his eyes in Eretz Yisrael, Mireishis from Rosh Hashanah, Reish Ad Achris Shana, until El, the end of the year. So the Yitav Lev says, Mireishis Hashana, with a hey, Achris is just Shana. So he says over a word, it's a famous word, many say it. He says, in the beginning of the year, we say, Ha, Shana, this is going to be the year. This is the year. But Achris, Shana, it was another year. It had its share of Shivrei Luchais too. But I think there's a very powerful message here. The Luchas Rishaynes and Luchas Shnias, Chazal say there were four differences between them. One of them, we said, one was written by the Ribbono Shel Olam, God. One is written by man. And what does that mean? You know your first Luchas, the first dream, when you got married, you see by weddings, he's going to be Rebbe Kivega, the girl is going to be Sara Imenu. I don't know, that sounds like a little bit tough. That sounds like pretty, you know, it was written by the Kavi Yachal, the first Luchas. That's pretty hard to live up to. You know, here's another thing. It says the Luchas Rishaynes, the first dreams, were given La'enei Koil, V'hu Yashmienu Barachmav Shenes, La'enei Kol Chai, the whole world watched. Oh, some people have weddings with 200, 400. I've been to weddings with 1,000 people. La'enei Kol Chai, maybe the first dreams, again, they were imposed upon us. Etzpa Likim means it wasn't written by us. Maybe our parents wanted these dreams for us. Maybe our friends in yeshiva, school, we were imitating them. It wasn't our dream, it was their dream. And Chazal say a third difference between the two Luchas is the first Luchas don't say Ki Toiv in them, but in the second Luchas, it says Laman Yitav Lach. And I think there's something powerful here. The first dreams, they weren't our dreams many times. They weren't realistic. The second one, the circumspect. We're thoughtful about it. A little bit like a second marriage. Everybody, it's eyes wide open. It says, look, second marriages are, you know, lefis chusay. What does that mean? The second time we dream, we're already mature. We've made the mistakes. We hopefully have retained the first luchais, those shattered, and we didn't bury them, but we put them in the arayin to say, you know, how do I learn from that so that my second dream is just more realistic, and it's more me, it's more authentic to who I am. So shivrei luchais munachais bara means if you see those shattered dreams, those broken luchais as a bad thing, That means it was an accident you went through. Not good. If you see those shattered dreams as it's a step, it's a learning process. It's part of your journey in life to bring you to a better place. The Luchas Shniyos brought us, the Luchas Rishaynos brought us to the Luchas Shniyos, where it does say Laman Yitav Lach, because they're yours and they're real and you can accomplish them and you can embrace them. Then the Luchas Rishaynos, the shadow, there was nothing wrong about that. It's a step that you have to go through. Like when you ride a bike and first you turn to the right too hard and you bump and then you turn to left. Those are all part of learning how to ride the bike. So in this Achris Shana, what does it say? The end of the year, the Torah calls it. Right? When it's not Hashana, but you know what? The great Megala Muka says, those dreams, they're in the Arin too. So don't feel bad at the end of the essay. All that's just going to be experience, and I'm going to be wiser. And you know, the person saying this, the Megala Muka, I was by his scene in Krakow. It says on it, Asher Diber Im Elio Panim El Panim. And the story that goes behind it supposedly is that he was a great goyin and a tzaddik, and he told his mother, I don't want to get married. I want to be like Ben Azai. I'm just going to learn my whole life. And they brought him shidduchim, the biggest and the best, and he just said, I want to learn my whole life. Every night he used to get up, he used to go to sleep and get up at 2 o'clock in the morning to learn. And his mother knew what a tzaddik he was, so she used to get up early and make him a glass of tea. One time she had to go away. So she said, I'm going to ask the Misharis, a girl next door in the neighborhood who's very kind, to make you the tea at 2 o'clock. Next morning, his mother comes back from the journey. He says, Ma, I want to marry that girl. She said, Nasanata, your whole life you never wanted a shidduch. He says, No, this is the girl. And they say, he said, what was the thing? Every night, his mother would bring him a cup of tea. This girl, she came in, she looked, and she brought two cups of tea, one for him. One she put down next to him. She was the first one who saw that he learned with Eliyahu HaNavi. This is the verse of the Megala Mukas. Elul, take those broken dreams this year, put them in your Aron, because they're going to enrich you. When you rebuild them, you'll be smarter. And you know, we learned a few weeks ago the Haftarah of Shimshon. Very few people in history in the Torah were born with the crescendo of Shimshon. A Navi, a Malach Hashem, came to Manoach and his wife many times, repeatedly, Belahavesh. And they said, you are going to have a son who's going to save the Yidden from the Pelishtim. Pelishtim were, they didn't, you know, it was terrible times. There was no Moshe Dayan, but it was really a very bad time for Klal Yisrael. He's going to be Mashiach Yisrael Miat Pelishtim. And you know what? He's going to be also a Tzaddik. Kadosh Hashem. He's going to be a Nazir, Kol Yemei Chayav. And he's going to be mighty. He's going to be a Shofet, a Gibor, a Tzaddik, everything you could want. A Navi, Shimshin. And they wait, and she was an Akara, and the child is born. He's everything they said. And then what happens? He says, Vayered el haPelishtim, and he sees a beautiful girl, and he falls in love with her. And to shock of his parents, he marries her. Then he divorces her, finds another woman, and then a third one, Delilah. And everybody's like, wow, like Vayered Pliam, the dreams. And you know, it's really a mashal. The Isha, the beautiful woman, it's the person, all of us have that beautiful woman. What drew you away? What took us away from our concentration, the mission that we were supposed to be? The chassan and kawa that we once were, the yeshiva bacha, what took us away from there? Was it the Isha Pelishtis? Was it Delilah? Whatever it was, something took us away. And then he loses his hear. Kadesh Yeh Gadol Peres HaRoshei, the Mekoyer of his Koyach, that his Nekuda Kedusha, he loses it. But one thing he doesn't lose, Shimshon HaGibor. It says, when Yaakov Avinu was Mespal for Shimshon, what does he say on him? Lishu Ascha Kivisi Hashem. And Rashi says that what? Rashi says, when Shimshon was in the worst place in his life, what does he say? He says, Zachreinina V'chaskeini, V'yoymer Hashem Aleikim, Zachreinina V'chaskeini. It's true. I lost my vision. I lost my hear, the Gad Kadosh Yeh. I went out of the faith. But Rabbi Shalom, I never stopped saying, Lishu Ascha Kivisi Hashem. All these errors, there's a lesson here. Someplace there's a lesson buried here that will bring me to my mission. And what was his mission? To be Mashiach Klal Yisrael Miad Pelishtim. And ultimately, what does he do? They create this huge thing that says tens of thousands came to the spectacle, and they all die. He said he killed more at the moment than he ever killed in his wars. He accomplished his mission. He goes with his mission. His reason for living is over. But the person, he never, Lishu Ascha Kivis Hashem, he recognized that with hope and with belief that those Shivrei Luchais Amunachais Ba'arein, not to deny and say, oh, Sa'alts Giveng Good. No, those Shivrei Luchais are there for us to learn from, to be part of our journey, to take us where? To Tichle Shana Vekil Leiseh, Tachel Shana Uberchaseh Elul, Arein Luchais, Vishivrei Luchais, Munachem Ba'arein. And now for the riddle of the week. On Rosh Chodesh Elul, you have Baruch Nafshi and LeDavid. What comes first? The Paiskim say you say Baruch Nafshi first, because you say it 12 times a year in Rosh Chodesh. So Tadir, Vishayne Tadir, Tadir Kaidim. The question is, we say Baruch Nafshi 12 times a year. LeDavid starts on Rosh Chodesh Elul, and it goes till Hoshana Rabbah. So we say it, give or take, I don't know, around 50 times a year, Berach. So if this is 50 and this is 12, why is Rosh Chodesh called Tadir? Why don't you say, well, David is Tadir? Because we say it four times as much as we say Baruch Nafshi. So you should say that David is the Tadir and Baruch Nafshi is the Einei Tadir. It's more prevalent. That is the riddle of the week. Let's go to our host.
Shalom uvracha. And welcome to the headline show, Yeshiva Shemaila. My name is Yoshua Pfeffer, filling in for Rav David this week. And this week's parasha, Parasha Shoftim, is a parasha that deals predominantly, at least to a large degree, with questions of politics. What is the political mechanism by which the Jewish state, the state of Eretz Israel, of Klal Israel in Eretz Israel, should be managed? How should it operate? The Torah speaks in this week's parasha about shoftim v'shoitrim, about establishing a judiciary and an executive. The Torah speaks about the question of azakin mamre, what happens when you have a dispute. Speak about the appointment of the melech, of the king, about his obligations, about the limitations on his power. We speak about the kohanim, the rights of the kohanim and the levim, who are the spiritual leaders of Klal Israel, and other issues about wars and about other issues related to the mechanisms of government, of governing in the Jewish state. And it's an appropriate week, it's an appropriate time to speak about politics generally, and specifically we have a very fascinating and potentially very significant event that took place earlier in the week, which was the accord, or the future accord, at the very least, the statement of intent of normalization of relations between Israel, the state of Israel, the Jewish state in the political sense, and the United Arab Emirates. This is a new kind of peace treaty. It's a new kind of agreement. It's a breakthrough in many ways that we'll be discussing. At the same time, there was also a significant concession. Israel gave up, at the very least, suspended the plans to annex, to apply sovereignty to great areas of Eretz Israel, Judea, Samaria, Bekat HaYarden, the Jordan Valley. All of these are important strategic areas, but they're also areas of Eretz Israel. And we'll be discussing the meaning of, on the one hand, the accord, the peace treaty, the normalization, on the other hand, giving up this perspective, this potential for annexation. And we'll be discussing what happened behind the scenes, what's the strategic meaning. But perhaps even more importantly than that, we'll also be discussing the Torah approach. What should be? Is there a Torah approach? How can we approach this issue from a Torah perspective? We're often unused to thinking about strategic issues from a Torah angle, from a Torah perspective. The Pasuk in Eicha says, Malka v'sarea b'goyim ein Torah. A significant, a huge part of Torah is related to Malka v'sarea, is related to this framework, this mechanism that we discuss in this week's parasha. The Kohanim and the Melech and the Shoftim and the Shoftrim and so on. And without that mechanism in place, so ein Torah, we don't have Torah because our Torah doesn't have its contemporary relevance on a state level, on a state of government. The Gemara says, the Gemara is in the beginning of Chagiga, the Gemara speaks about three dema'os, three tears that Klal Israel shed over the Golas. And the Gemara says it's Mikdash Rishon and Mikdash Sheni, and another one on Bittul Torah. And the Gemara says, well, there's a machlokes, two opinions. One opinion is Golas from the land, and the other Bittul Torah. And the Gemara says, Bishlam Golas, that's what it means, Kinishba Eder Hashem. But what does that pasuk mean if it was speaking about Bittul Torah? Why is that relevant? And says the Gemara, Kevan Shigolu Yisrael Mimakoimon, because Klal Israel were exiled from their land, Einacha Bittul Torah Godol Mizeh. That itself is Bittul Torah. And I think that one aspect of that Bittul Torah, which is related to the Golas from the land, is the inability, the lack of capacity for Torah to be contemporary, to be relevant on a governing level, on a level of policy, on a level of how to run a good society. How do you run a foreign ministry? Alpi Torah. How do you run an economy? Alpi Torah. How do you think about all these great and significant policy questions based on Torah? And even though there are millions of Yidden who have returned to Eretz Israel, I think specifically in this sense, we're still very, very much deep in Kivan Shegolim Ha'atzom, Mimakoimam, Einacha Bittul Torah. We still haven't given serious consideration and serious thought to the question of running a state Alpi Torah. I recall a conversation that I once had with a Haredi politician in Israel, and I asked him the following question. I asked him, what would you do if you woke up the day after the elections And it turns out that the Haredi parties have a majority. They want a majority of seats. Don't ask me which constellation this might happen in. I don't think it's a realistic proposition at this time, but a theoretical proposition. Hypothetically, what would you do the morning after the election if you would have a majority of seats? And his response, a little bit tongue-in-cheek, but it's still very telling, his response was, we would call up President Trump and we would petition to become the 51st state of the United States. Meaning, we don't know what to do. We don't have instruction. We don't have guidance. We've never thought, we've never dedicated our time and effort from a Torah perspective, from a Torah angle, on how to run a modern country, how to run a modern state. And even though we're lacking a lot of tools in this, I think that this specific event of the Israel-United Arab Emirates Accord is an opportunity to think, at the very least, to open up a discussion on some level. And I think we're light years away. We have a long, long way to go on so many levels in this broader issue of Torah, of policy al pi Torah. But at the very least, it's worth raising the question. So that's what we'll be talking about. We'll be talking on the one hand about understanding how to really wrap our heads around what happened here. Number one, how did it happen? What brought it about? There's a lot of information that the civil, that the broader society is not necessarily aware of. And we'll be bringing some very fascinating insider accounts to understand what happened here. We'll have a broader strategic analysis of the pros and cons of what happened here. And we'll also be speaking about the Torah perspective with two important rabbinic figures that have what to say. One of them is Rabbi Stephen Pruzansky, Rabbi Emeritus of Bnei Yeshurun in Teaneck, well known for expressing political opinion and for having opinion about policy al pi Torah, and Rabbi Yitzchak Adlerstein, who's been for many years Director of Interfaith Affairs for the Simon Wiesenthal Center. And from the strategic vantage point, we'll be hosting David Weinberg, who is Vice President of the Jerusalem Institute for Strategy and Security. With us today to discuss the significance, the process, and indeed the Torah approach to this historic accord between Israel and the United Arab Emirates is Rabbi Yitzchak Adlerstein. Apart from being a close friend and colleague, Rabbi Adlerstein is Director of the Interfaith Affairs, Director of Interfaith Affairs for the Simon Wiesenthal Center. He's also the founding editor of Cross Currents and Mechaber Sfarim on the Maharal, the Slonim Rebbe, other Sfarim. Rabbi Yitzchak, really thank you very much. It's an honor and a pleasure to be able to host you on the show. So thank you for joining us.
Thank you. It's always great to spend time with you, Rabbi Yoshua, and what a week this has been. I never thought I would see the day where MBZ produces more excitement in our community than MBD. But it did happen this week.
All right, you'll fill us in on exactly why we should be excited in a minute. But let me just open up with a general question, and that is the following: many analysts, and that includes some of the guests on this week's show, look at the ultimate results that we saw this week of this accord, or at the very least, the statement of intent towards normalization, as being the natural outcome of a decades-long process, an unfolding process of closer ties between Israel and the Emirates. And that's because of economic connections, that's because of collaboration on whether it's military, even on intelligence on some level, because the enemy of your enemy is your friend on a certain level. And ultimately, that's what came to a head in this agreement to go towards normalization. But I understand from you, and this is from our preliminary discussion, that there's more going on behind the scenes. This also came out in your recent post on Cross Currents. And I'd like you please to share some of that, whatever you can, of course, with the listeners, to explain how, from your perspective, what was it that catalyzed this? What enabled it to move forward?
I wrote my piece on Cross Currents really to convey the Musar Haskel to our own community about how important human players are in dramas that we think unfold just because those are the laws of nature. What you described, Rabbi Yehoshua, would sort of be like saying that, you know, 500 years ago we started the Western world started the Industrial Revolution, the Scientific Revolution, and Enlightenment. That led to major brain surgery today, and not look at all the people along the way, including the surgeons who performed the surgery. Nothing is inevitable in the world of politics. There's still some people who like the Marxist way of looking at history of inevitable laws. But in the end, what we see is hard work by human beings, responsible human beings who see an opening, Ezehu Chacham Haroes Anolad, and say, you know, there's something that maybe we can do for the Jewish people, the Jewish state, and move on it. And I wrote my piece in Cross Currents to first link to an important piece in Newsweek by my colleague at the Simon Wiesenthal Center. For those of us who don't know us, we are the largest Jewish membership organization in North America. We've been working world politics and fighting anti-Semitism and fighting for Torah for decades, because we're on the West Coast. Sometimes we get less publicity than some of the East Coast people, but we've been out there. So it did not surprise us entirely when we got an overture really from the King of Bahrain, who's one of the Gulf players. Bahrain has its own political situation and was looking, for a variety of reasons, and I said there were very, very complex issues in their relationship with not only Iran, but with their relationship with Saudi Arabia. And I might add, a 100-year history of religious tolerance in this Arab state. But they wanted the American public to know a little bit more about it. And they approached us. They figured, you know, we're out there. Our name is in the news. We speak to world leaders. Maybe some of these Jews can do something to help us improve our image. That was one.
They approached you. So Bahrain basically approached you as PR campaigners on their behalf.
Exactly, and what was
your interest to forward their public image of Bahrain?
The image was that when we found out that they actually did have a good record on religious tolerance, there's a street in their mm-hmm. capital where they have Sunni mosque, Shiite mosque, Catholic church, Protestant church, and Lahavdil, mm-hmm. a shul on the same mm-hmm. street,
wow.
and people don't kill each other.
Really?
And there's even a Shomer Shabbos woman who's on the king's council. This is the kind of thing that most of us don't know about.
Right.
Most of us look, you know, an Arab is an Arab.
Right, and simply we have an interest in publicizing such a thing as a demonstration, meaning as an example for others to follow. Listen, it can be done.
And to tell you the truth, we thought that maybe this could go further, that this is a possibility. We suggested from the get-go that, you know, one of the things that would really help is understanding a little bit more about Israel and softening the hatred to Israel, and maybe a couple of people could visit. And what we did for the king, and please, I have to emphasize, Yehoshua, I could go on for a long time. I ask people to go to my Cross Currents piece, find the link to the Newsweek piece by Rabbi Cooper, and you'll see some of the other activities, and some of there are more that are not mentioned in there. The point that I'm trying to make is that there's a human role. Rabbi Hayyur and Rabbi Cooper went to speak to the king. There's a teches involved, and some of them came to Los Angeles. I sat once. I prepared the first draft of the Declaration of Religious Freedom for the king. I then sat in a hotel room in Los Angeles doing a second draft with someone who I imagine we'll speak about later, a good friend I just got off the Zoom call with, Johnny Moore, an incredibly important and wonderful, wonderful mensch of an evangelical leader. And we're sitting there writing this thing, and a representative of the king comes into the room. He's there to oversee the whole thing. And he starts talking. He was an unusually tight-lipped person, really a consummate professional. Didn't open up about anything, but I guess he was bored that day. And he told us that he had just gotten back from a secret trip to Israel. And now it's not so secret anymore. And a whole delegation came to Israel. But by then, at that point, it was secret. It was arranged. We helped arrange. It did take the cooperation of the Israeli of the foreign ministry, and they were in on this also. And he tells us, I just came back from Israel. I didn't get a chance to see the whole country, but I went to two cities. I went to Tel Aviv, and I went to Jerusalem. And he said, Tel Aviv. Wow, what an exciting city! It's big. It's cosmopolitan. It's urbane. It's exciting. And then I went to Jerusalem, and I'm expecting him to say, this is some backward medieval city. And I'm getting ready to try to defend the covenant of Yerushalayim. And he said, I didn't like Tel Aviv. It's just another urban jungle. Jerusalem.
Right. It's like Dubai.
Listen to what he said. Jerusalem, quote, you can feel the presence of God walking in the streets.
Wow.
Pause.
That's a nice
understand.
For us Jerusalem dwellers. Wow.
Exactly. And then he said, I understand why you want this as your capital.
Wow.
Now, it's a small example. It was meaningful at the time. There were some comic moments. After the king got through with our draft, he made changes, made substantive changes, but it did result in a declaration which was not the first, but was unique because he actually said that compelling people to act on matters of conscience just doesn't do God any good. We don't force people to become Muslims. And they wanted to make a big splash for it. We had a big dinner in Los Angeles, invited the press. So I'm at this dinner, and before everybody gets seated, all of a sudden I hear a bunch of Scottish bagpipes in the background. I'm trying to say, what is going on here? Scottish bagpipes at a dinner between some Bahrainis and some Lower East Side Jews transplanted to Los Angeles? Like, what is this? And then this whole bagpipe group comes in playing bagpipes and dressed with Arab white turbans. And I'm like, what did they put in my drink? And then somebody reminded me, I should have thought this myself, Bahrain used to be a British colony.
British colony, so they were exposed to Scots.
they picked up the bagpipes from the British. And it was...
bring us up to speed, though. How do we get from here to the United Arab Emirates Accord with Israel? And what do you think? Will Bahrain be the next country in line? Tell us now how we're getting from here to the...
Bahrain may be, we hope it will be. One of the things that I have to emphasize along the way is that, you make a suggestion, maybe we could do a joint project, maybe we'll help you with your museum, maybe we'll send somebody over to teach Jewish law. And sometimes they say no, and sometimes they 6 months can go by and they're not able to do anything because there's pushback and internal things in their own ranks. And you have to be patient. And you learn that you don't always push for what your agenda is. You develop the human relationship. And that happened here again and again and again, particularly with Rabbi Hayyur and Rabbi Cooper. I was not involved with that. But this happened with Bahrain. It happened with Dubai. It happened with the UAE. And it's going to continue to happen. So one of the points that I made was just don't discount
the value of human relations, of people who have their eye on the ball of what's good for the Jewish people and act responsibly for it, even when they can't milk it for headlines right away. And because they're using their seichel and their power selectively to achieve the final goal. This is an important part of it. This is not just a course of history that played out. Now, there were other players involved as well. The Trump administration certainly has a hand in this and has an interest in it. And that interest has more to do with expectations out of the evangelical community than it does out of the Jewish community. Donald Trump embarrassed a lot of us this week when he said that, you know, I moved the embassy to Jerusalem. Said the Jews didn't seem to care so much. I did it for the evangelicals. They were more excited about it than the Jews. You know, Nebuch. He does know that.
Yes, I heard that statement. Yeah.
That people who listen to this radio program.
I guess there are more evangelical voters out there than there are potential Jewish Trump voters. So that's more behind the statement than a sincere, you know, statement.
Well, it does point out to the complexity of politics and diplomacy. I suspect that many of our readers are thrilled by events of the last 4 years and the difference between the way the Trump administration has treated Israel as opposed to the administration before. And yet, some people are not so pleased about a price that, you know, the administration in Washington is going to do things that it considers to be in their interest. And you get involved in any kind of relationship with any potential ally, whether they're in the Gulf or whether they're in Foggy Bottom. And you know that there's a price. There's a tit for tat. Mm-hmm. And sometimes things don't go exactly the way you want. Then you do pay a price. So we have this now Abraham Accord, which right now is only a declaration of intent. It will be worked out over the next months, and I imagine it will be signed to some great fanfare, which they're entitled. But
it's election season, and everything is legitimate in election season. But let me pick up on the comment that you made now about the price. Some are arguing, and I'm sure you're aware of this discussion taking place, I guess on the right wing or the right side of the right wing in Israel, and many in that wing are arguing that the price that Israel paid over here in terms of the wasted opportunity of applying sovereignty to huge areas of Judea, Samaria, and some very strategic areas for example, in the Jordan Valley, and so on, that this would have been like a very opportune time to do that in the twilight of the Trump administration. We don't know what's going to happen in another few months' time. And by making this this deal or this agreement with the United Arab Emirates, so we've given up on that opportunity, meaning Netanyahu, for some are arguing for personal reasons, some will say for strategic, whatever it is. How would you react to that? You're obviously, or you seem to be, taking a very positive outlook towards this agreement.
So for two reasons. I don't think that we lost anything that's permanent. It's a delay. It doesn't mean it won't be exercised in the future. Yes, some people would have liked it now and said we had the opportunity to strike while the iron is hot. But you know, the Israeli electorate is not standing behind that push for sovereignty. Lots of people, maybe even a majority, not so clear about whether they wanted to push for that because of a price, again, that they would have to pay. With the EU, which is an enormously important trading partner, even if politically they're not so great for us, and the parties are not all of one mind, it's going to have to be the Israeli electorate, in the absence of a Sanhedrin Haggadah that's going to paskin this, the Israeli electorate is going to have to decide it. And they are very, very much not of one mind about this. This was taken as a great relief. The price that was paid to many people here in Israel was taken as, wow, so lucky that we found a way out of that. Now, I'm not saying that's my opinion or your opinion.
Well, let me just interject.
Let me tell you why I think it was a price that was worthwhile. Because Ein Safek Motzi Midei Vaday, people are not looking at the character of this accord. It's not something that you could have, even if you discount everything I said before and everything I will say, it's not like the peace treaty with Egypt or with Jordan. Those resulted in cold peace and an absence of hostility, but nothing compared to what this accord is about. When you see Bahraini girls sending messages to the Israeli electorate in Ivrit and talking about how they're looking forward to shalom and connection between the people, we're talking normalization. Normalization is not something we've had with anyone since the founding of the state. And normalization, b'derech hateva, I'm not a Navi, but b'derech hateva should not be reversible. Not in an era of social media, of where people get to know other people, of where they're going to be stronger commercial, academic, tourist ties than ever before. You're not going to be able to stick that genie back in the bottle. This will spill out to other areas of the Arab world where they'll see that you can get along with Jews and the Jewish state, and you don't wind up getting swallowed into the abyss of hell. This is incredibly important.
Okay, so let me, you're making two arguments, and let me just separate those two arguments out. One argument that you're making is that this deal, this agreement, this direction is very, very significant. And therefore, the price of not going through with annexation, of applying sovereignty, is worth it. It's worth it because of the importance of this agreement, which could have this domino effect into other Arab countries, and which ultimately, and you haven't spelled this out, but it's implicit in what you're saying, ultimately this will also be of great benefit vis-a-vis the Palestinian issue, because they'll understand that even their own brethren, even the Arab states, are no longer interested in their plight, and they're not going to take their belligerence and their inexcusable stance, their position vis-a-vis Israel. So that's on the one hand what you're saying is that it's worth it. That's like a substantive argument. But I'd like to pick up on the other argument which you made, which was that it depends on the Israeli electorate, right? In the absence of a Sanhedrin, we have to go with the electorate. And my question to you on that is that really the case? Meaning, shouldn't we be trying to think about what does the Torah want? What's the right policy in terms of Yiddishkeit, in terms of halacha, in terms of the Torah, and to try to have that, obviously, no one's asking us, but at the very least that we should have a developed opinion on what would be the right thing, meaning that there's a real question here of, for example, you know, some will argue that sovereignty is the epitome of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, which is a national mitzvah, even before it's a personal mitzvah. Others will argue that, you know, that there's questions, of course, of Pikuach Nefesh and so on. But in any case, that the arena to clarify the right thing isn't the Israeli electorate, but rather a certain Das Torah. And I don't mean Das Torah now in which Godel says what, but I mean in clarifying what's the Torah position. How would you think about that?
I would think lots about that, but I would think that, again, in the absence of a Sanhedrin, we know that there are chilukei deos even in the Torah world. To mention sort of the extremes, you had on the one hand the Lubavitcher Rebbe Zatzal, who certainly felt that it was usher to give up a single inch once we were able to possess it and came into its possession after the Six-Day War. On the other hand, you had a position like Rav Soloveitchik, who said that if it really, really could be demonstrated, that giving back, I don't even want to say which part of the country he said he'd give back, if it could be demonstrated that it would really save Jewish lives, again, speaking in the theoretical, happening in the pragmatic, that he would say, go ahead with it. There are chilukei deos in the Torah community. I'm not sure if we're allowed to say that on this radio show. I suppose that we are. We're not all of one mind there.
It's been said before on this radio show. I think you're okay on this. So go ahead.
Okay. Everybody who is a Baal Shita, who is part of a way, a well thought out, coherent way of referring to these issues, should speak his mind, campaign with the public, try to speak up in a cabinet meeting if they're a member of Knesset. But for the rest of us trying to figure out, those of us who can't really affect that process directly, is this good for the Jews or bad for the Jews? We can at least comfort ourselves with the notion that Tein li yavne v'chachomeha is a kosher hanhaga. That sometimes when we're offered an opportunity and we don't get everything that we want, we do look at the most practical way of navigating. The resistance to Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai, who made that deal with the Romans, was not that he employed a kind of political pragmatism, but that he factually was wrong. And the Gemara says that Meshiva Chachamim Achar, but the idea that he was willing to accept an extremely uncomfortable compromise because it was the best that he could get, or he thought he could get under the circumstances, is not a treif idea.
Mm-hmm. It's not right. It's not a meaning. I understand what you're saying, and I think that this approach has been adopted, you know, by a significant part, certainly of the Haredi leadership. It remained a controversial, as it were, approach, because to take up Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai's statement, which was made, or his policy, which was implemented at the time of the Churban, and to apply it today at a time when we have sovereignty over the greater part of Eretz Yisrael, and that sovereignty is not under threat, it's not threatened right now in any sense, as it was at the time of the Churban, is a chiddush. Meaning it's not something which is unanimously accepted.
It's not unanimously accepted. At the same time, it is not unanimously accepted that having a Jewish state now puts us in the driver's seat, as if we don't have to worry about pragmatism like other people do. I'm not explaining my position. I can't even tell you what my position is because I don't have it clear so much in my mind. I'm not an anti-Zionist. I'm probably at least as much of a Zionist as you are, and we'll say that even in places where Zionism is a dirty word, I don't see it as a dirty word. But I daven for Mashiach every day. Part of davening for Mashiach is the realization that even in a Jewish state, we don't have all of the control and the sovereignty that we'd like. People who think that they do, I respect them. Maybe they're right, but they're not Rove Minyan and Rove Binyan of the community either. I don't know if there's any one Shita that is, but I think that for most of us
part of our problem, Rav Yitzchak, is that we're not even able to bring the different Shitas and Baalei Shitas into the same room so they can discuss it.
Right.
So, you know, we're far from reaching such a solution, if you want, or a consensus, because we're not even talking to each other. We should return to such an era where we're able to reach a consensus and able to track policy based on Torah.
I am far more concerned with Yeshua, with the substantial number of people in our community who, for various reasons, concerned with the way we do chinuch in our schools, just don't understand the centrality and the importance of Eretz Yisrael. We darken the conversation so much by yelling, Yitzhayim and Kaifrem, and therefore anything connected with it, our kids are cheated of understanding what Eretz Yisrael is, what Nisim went into the establishment of the state, what steps it took, the amazing Hashkocha of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, which Gedolim felt that way, and who are now not and who are now not studied. I think that's a much bigger problem than figuring out whether this deal is going to win the approval of every sector of people in the community who actually do care. I'm more worried about the large number of UNSRA who don't care enough.
Right, but I think, first of all, I agree very much with what you're saying. I also think that once you care enough, then you also begin to care about the lack of a Torah expression, about the lack of discussion from a Torah perspective of the rights and wrongs of different policy issues. But you know what? Let me go back to the narrow conversation about this agreement, about this this accord. And let me just make one more argument, which is often raised or has been raised over the week, and that is that there seems to be a lack of symmetry in terms of concession, right? Israel has to make this concession about not annexing, not applying sovereignty to broad areas of Eretz Israel, while the Emirates are not making ostensibly any concession. And then the question, well, Bahrain will come on the bandwagon, and then they'll demand another concession from Israel and Oman and Saudi Arabia and so on. And then Israel will be making all these concessions. And isn't this setting a problematic precedent?
I would question that designation. We're the ones who are making the concessions and they're not. You have to understand where they are in a very volatile Arab world, caught betwixt and between many different strains. Right? The Saudis, who we thought and we hope will come into line eventually, that's the big prize at the end. But they said, you know, low with a capital Lamed this week, not until we clear up the Palestinian question. There's still a lot of pressure, in a lot of places. Nice. And they are being absolutely vilified in parts of the Arab world. It puts them at a security risk. It puts them at a risk with parts of their own populations. I don't think that's true. It's true at all that committing to normalization. Maybe the idea will open up another trade mission. Fine, but that is not what this accord is about. We're talking about flights. An astute political scientist who happens to be our go-to person at the Wiesenthal Center on political matters said once that diplomats sign documents, people make peace. The fact that they're going to be flights, that there'll be tourist connections is a great concession on their part, one that they're going to pay a price for. And I don't think we should look at it as if we hired the wrong accountant when you look at the ledgers at the ledger sheet. I do hope we can talk about another
Netanyahu,
part.
He's done good accounting. Sorry, go ahead.
He has. There's another part of this which I mentioned in my article, which I want to make sure that we cover, and that was how much the events of this week belied the characterization of the evangelical community.
Right, I was actually going to get to that, Rabbi Yitzchak, and let me just pose the question, because you mentioned before evangelicals, you mentioned them twice. You mentioned them once concerning your own connections with Bahrain at the Simon Wiesenthal Center, and I guess this is part of the interfaith section that you have, and then you also mentioned it concerning Trump's policy decisions and his, as it were, playing to the hand or the strong hand of the evangelical community in the United States. And you know, let me throw out the question. The question is, many people, both Israelis specifically, and I think many Jewish people everywhere, certainly from Jews, view the evangelicals with some suspicion, meaning it's true that we have some common ground in terms of America, in terms of moral issues, in terms of Supreme Court cases and so on, religion and state. But on the other hand, when it comes to Israel, the suspicion is that the evangelicals have a very strong self-interest here. And from their perspective, it's all about, you know, the second coming of their own Messiah. And from their perspective, they're waiting for the Jews to convert to Christianity and to accept their faith rather than to cling to their own faith. How would you kind of balance between that suspicion on the one hand and on the other hand your clear enthusiasm to accept them and to welcome them as partners?
Well, two important points. One is that there certainly are evangelicals like that. They are a minority, but it's a large population. There are 800 million, they claim, evangelicals around the world, and there's certainly people who still subscribe to that. I've been working this community for the sole purpose of building bridges that will help the Jewish people and the Jewish state for close to 20 years. I've met lots of people, and I know the kind of people you're talking about exist, but I haven't met one yet. The people I meet have a different agenda, and I don't expect anybody to accept it just on my say-so. They may have to find out for themselves, but I'm telling you that it is true. That's been my experience, and I'm a skeptic. I'm a good Lipschitz skeptic, not ready to just sing some Pollyanna kind of a tune because there's some people who smile at us and show us a little love. There are people there who feel a real kinship to the Jewish people. Why HaKadosh Baruch Hu was Masada this, I don't know. I suspect he has a great sense of humor and like the idea of taking our tormentors from 2,000 years and turning them into our best allies. But I will tell you, Rabbi Yoshua, I have spoken literally to Gedolei Yisrael, who said, they're not going to say it in public, but it would be a sakana to lose the support of this community. They're the last big ally out there. And we have to, Chazal tell us, Chazdeyu v'chabdeyu, it's great advice. We should not lose either one of those two words. We build the bridges, we
right,
look
at
all.
But you're saying that 20 years
the,
of experience has lessened your chazdeyu. You've been there 20 years, and from
not
your
my vigilance,
it's sincere.
It, among some people, and you learn who those people are and how to differentiate between the ones who are problematic or not. We won't have anything to do with anybody who's tainted in any way, first degree, second degree, third degree, missionizing or proselytizing to Jews. We're not ready to sacrifice Jewish neshamas, but we don't believe we're doing that. And we find people who are tremendous mention and who have a real appreciation for the Devar Hashem, probably because the notion that anybody could believe that God speaks to people and has real instructions that don't change is something that is so fraught today in secular society, and they take it as a chizuk that there are people who still believe in that, and they thirst for some instruction and guidance that comes from the Word of God. They're not going to convert, but they like the idea that the Word of God is real, people live by it, and that it works. In this case,
the
other point that I wanted to make.
Jewish community, well, they look at the Jewish community as a source of inspiration?
They look at the Orthodox community, parts of the Orthodox community. They know it's not perfect, but some of the Orthodox Jews they've met, they see as the kind that has having the kind of enthusiasm. I tell you, I met a guy within the last year who was befriended a particular Hispanic pastor in Central California. He was Indian by birth, and how he got attached to him, I don't know, but this Hispanic pastor supervises a network of pro-Israel churches throughout California, Mexico, and Central America. Thousands and thousands and thousands of people. Anyway, he was chiding this pastor, who's a friend of mine, and said, you're so cozy to the Jews. I don't get it. I don't get it. You know what the Jews are? And they don't believe in God. The Jews are all atheists. So my friend did an incredibly smart thing. He took this guy and he dropped them off, this is before Corona, at the Kotel at 2 in the morning and left them there for 4 hours.
Wow.
I heard it from the guy myself. He said he was transfigured by it. These are atheists. He saw people in the middle of the night come and stand before the kotel, pouring their hearts out to the Ribono Shel Olam.
Nice move. So, I like that. Play to the person's experience. Let me ask
the second point that I want to make is that, yes, there's always been a lot of skepticism. I encourage the skepticism. Try to speak to people who have experience and find out why. But listen to this. The reasons for the skepticism are different in our community than they are in the general community. In our community, we're worried about mishumadim. We're worried about people who are going to chas v'shalom steal Jewish neshamas. The rest of the community, it's because evangelicals are Bible thumpers and they're against abortion and they take the wrong position on LGBT issues. And worst of all, for Israel, they are fanatics and extremists, and they are going to push Israel to make political decisions that are unhealthy for it, that'll suit their agenda. They are the true believers in Eretz Yisrael Hashleima, and they will force the hand of the Israeli administration. They brook no compromise. And guess what happened? All the churches that prided themselves on being peace above everything else and became the supporters of BDS and Kairos have come up with nothing, nada, for peace or even for the Palestinians, except a lot of hatred for the Jewish state. And these evangelicals are supposed to be the extremists and would never agree to anything to give up an inch, who are more tanoim about sovereignty or annexation, as they call it, than we are, said, wow, what a great step. We might actually achieve some peace here. So these absolutely frothing at the mouth, crazy, idiotic Bible thumpers prove themselves to be the most practical realists in this whole drama. And that hasn't penetrated to the rest of America yet. But that is one of the takeaways from this past week.
Fascinating. I'm gonna skip the question I meant to ask because I think we're at the risk of going over time. Let me just ask you, come on, Rabbi Yitzchak, who are the Gedolim that you mentioned before? Give us some names.
I will give you those names when you are ready to give the names of those who have told you certain things that you talk about. I want my windows broken and their windows broken? come on. We should do another story about why we can't reveal the sources of important shitas in the Haredi world today. We're not going to pretend that's not the case. I'm not going to give you a single
shlita,
name.
If there's shlita or there's zatzal, you're not even giving that.
The zatzals, they have no problem telling what they are. No, they're very much alive.
All right. Rabbi Yitzchak, I really deeply appreciate your coming on. Thank you very much. And I look forward to the next time.
Yeah, I hope we're both there at the Chanukah Sabayis of the new Kollel in Dubai.
It'll be a well-paying one, in HSM. It'll be an attractive Kollel.
I'm looking to become the Rosh Kollel. Kaltiv.
Kaltiv. Thank you. So with us now, we're very honored to have Rabbi Stephen Przanski. Rabbi Przanski is newly arrived in Eretz Israel, so it's really both an honor and a great pleasure to have a new neighbor, a chashuva neighbor in the Holy Land. Rabbi Przanski is Rabbi Emeritus of Congregation Bnei Yeshurun of Teaneck, New Jersey. I've had the honor of being a guest over there too for a number of Shabbosos. He's also senior rabbinic fellow at CJV, the Coalition for Jewish Values, where he's also the Eastern Regional Vice President. Rabbi Przanski, first of all, really thank you very much for joining us, for being with us.
It's a privilege to be in the land of Israel with you, and a pleasure, a delight to be on the interview with you as well today. Thank you.
Well, that's very kind. Thank you very much. And let me start with a broad and open-ended question. As we know, there was a really historic accord, which yesh darshan l'shvach, yesh darshan l'gnai, but it's certainly significant. an accord, a normalization of relations between Israel and between the United Arab Emirates. And there could be more down the list. At the same time, Israel has had to pay a price for this in terms of, at the very least, postponing, delaying the plans for annexation, for applying Israeli sovereignty to areas of Eretz Israel, areas of Judea, Samaria, the West Bank, which is all parts of Eretz Israel. And the question that I'd like to open with is, how does the Torah, or how do you see that the Torah would look at this, would give us guidance in how to look at which perspective to have on these very significant events, meaning the agreement on the one hand and the price we're paying for it on the other?
Obviously, a peace agreement between Israel and any Arab country is a wonderful achievement. And we have precedent for this in Jewish history going back to the time of Tanakh. Shlomo HaMelech, from a position of strength, entered into a number of agreements, treaties with surrounding countries, and even somewhat controversially took daughters of these kings to be his wife, all in order to cement these alliances. Now, Chazal were equivocal about this relationship, and the Gemara tells us in Shabbos that Kol Omer Shlomo Chata Eino Ela Torah. Whoever says Shlomo sinned is just wrong, meaning superficially his wives tried to incline his wife to idolatry, but he himself did not succumb. Nonetheless, there was a value in having these agreements in order to promote the general interests of the Torah and the Jewish people, particularly of Kimitzion Taitzei Torah Dvar Hashem Yerushalayim, that we are exporters of God's morality to the world. To the extent that we're able to do that, then of course treaties and agreements with other nations are most welcome. The main caveat that we have to have, and the reason why even towards this agreement the reaction should be somewhat equivocal, is that these agreements must always be based on parity, on a meeting of mutuals, and never result in compromising either principles of Torah or halacha, or certainly not compromising our sovereignty over the land of Israel. So that becomes the issue in this particular agreement with the United Arab Emirates, and the potential agreements that exist are being negotiated now that might come to fruition in the near future. Why was it necessary to make such a concession as to defer, or more likely waive, Israel's claim of sovereignty over Judea Samaria? When I speak of a relationship of parity, of equity, of equals between two nations, there was no anticipated concession on the part of the United Emirates. For that matter, there really was no state of war between Israel and the Emirates, nor is there casus belli. There's no reason why there should be any sense of aggression or hostility between these two countries. We're mindful of the fact that underwriting the agreement is not necessarily on the surface Avat Mordechai, love of Mordechai, but more Sinat Haman, hatred of Haman, the Persian. Here, in almost a literal sense, that Israel and the Emirates are acting based on the old adage that the enemy of my enemy is my friend. And both Israel and the Emirates and other Gulf states are wary of Iran's attempted hegemony in that part of the region, really throughout the Middle East. And therefore, it's natural that they would seek an alliance and join forces in order to combat the Iranian aggression. Of course, that being said, this took place already covertly, even somewhat less than covertly, over the last several years. If the realization of the agreement required this concession that Israel had to waive its claims of sovereignty over Judea and Samaria, then why is that necessary? It's almost setting the expectation that other agreements with other Arab states, whether it's Oman or Bahrain or Sudan, will also require some type of analogous concession on the part of Israel, without there really being any reciprocal concession from those countries. So I don't think Israel should enter into these agreements as a beggar or feeling as an inferior, as if somehow we don't deserve peaceful relations with our neighbors, even our extended neighbors. But they should approach it from the perspective of equals. And again, that being said, whenever there is an agreement between Israel and any Arab state, given Israel's traditional isolation in this part of the world, it's always welcome, but it shouldn't come at the expense of major principles of Torah, Jewish life, or Israeli sovereignty.
So, Representative, you would say, therefore, that, you know, despite the fact that this agreement, in a pragmatic sense, could be very helpful in terms of, you know, perhaps creating a domino effect, perhaps creating a coalition against, you know, the evil axis of Iran, Turkey, Russia, maybe China, you know, who knows? But if it's compromising our ideals, then it's wrong. Meaning we should not be, as it were, tempted to enter into such arrangements at the expense of compromising our ideals. Would you agree to that?
I would put it like this. All treaties, for that matter, all contracts, always reflect self-interest on the part of the parties who enter into the contract. Self-interest does not or should not necessitate a concession from just one side, because then it's no longer self-interest. There's another dynamic. So the way I approach it here is really from both sides. From the perspective of the Emiratis, they, of course, have an interest in peaceful, friendly, commercial, and strategic relations with the state of Israel, but they required a fig leaf to try to sell to the rest of the Arab world as if they're not just standing alone and going off on their own, making an individual arrangement, but rather they have...
Right, I mean, it's about betraying. They want to say they're not betraying the Palestinians, even though really they are betraying the Palestinians, but they want to be able to make an excuse and say that they're not. But again, so that's their concession, as it were, that they're prepared to make a normalization of relations with the... You know, the small Satan, you know, there's the big Satan, the small Satan. You know, this is a concession of thoughts. And I guess, you know, this is from a pragmatic perspective, it's a fig leaf, but it was a necessary fig leaf.
Well, yes and no, because there are two other interests here. One, the Emirates have an interest in furthering their ties with America, including in terms of weapons purchases, and coming under a strategic umbrella of the United States as well. Now, to some extent, that's existed already for decades. But people realize, because of the closeness of the relationship between the Trump administration and Israel, nations are perceived more favorably in the United States if they have warm relations with Israel. But by the same token, it has to be mentioned that had the Prime Minister Netanyahu wanted to annex the Judea Samaria or parts of it any time in the last 6 months, he could have done so. Notice how the July 1st deadline for action came and went. So my sense is he never really wanted to actually apply Israeli sovereignty to these areas. Whether he was holding it as a bargaining chip for just such an agreement or as a promise he can make in a future campaign, or both, so that's something that could be analyzed. But it seems that from all different perspectives, there was an interest in delaying, postponing, suspending, or waiving the application of sovereignty over to Judea Samaria because it satisfied the interests of all the parties. But does it really satisfy the long-term interests of the Jewish people? And we see annexation, or better said, application of sovereignty, whether it was in Yerushalayim in 1967, or the Golan in 1981, all these statements, these declarations, do have an effect, and they do represent a national commitment to securing and developing those areas. The reluctance sends a message both to the settlers in the area and the Palestinians and the surrounding Arab world that these lands, the heartland of Israel, is still up for negotiation. And that, of course, causes some pause.
So, if you, with your permission, this is not the first time that the question of, I'm framing it as pragmatism versus ideology. I know that it can be framed in different ways. But there were many rabbis, you know, many Gedolei Torah, certainly in the Haredi camp, who seemed very willing to give away or to compromise on the value of sovereignty over Eretz Israel for the sake of making a deal. This was true even of the Oslo Accord. Certainly Shas, you know, under Rabbi Avada Yosef, were happy to vote in favor of the Oslo Accords, and Rav Shach also was at the very least open to the kind of land for peace, if you want to call it that way. It's maybe an inaccurate representation, certainly historically, but that's often how it's presented. Your approach would be very opposed. I'm assuming, or so it sounds, that your approach would be very opposed to that kind of rabbinic direction or that line of thought.
This is an old dispute that really erupted after the Six-Day War. I remember that in the Haredi world, the most outspoken against the surrender of any land was always the Lubavitcher Rebbe. But even in terms of Rav Shach, there are different approaches to his understanding of the area. One would be to say very simply that the dictates of Pikuach Nefesh supersede the possession of any particular territory in the land of Israel. That's a harder approach from a number of perspectives. You know, the Minchas Chinuch said explicitly that Yishuv Eretz Yisrael is Docha Pikuach Nefesh, because obviously there's a mitzvah to conquer the land of Israel. Conquest involves war. War involves death. And therefore, it's understandable. So it's almost, it's not part. There are three cardinal mitzvot that exist that supersede Pikuach Nefesh, as we know. But he said categorically, Yishuv Eretz Yisrael was Docher as well. I think there was a
couple those mitzvahs are personal mitzvahs. Yishuv Eretz Yisrael is a national mitzvah. It's a different category.
It is a different category. So the Minchas Chinuch said that Pikuach Nefesh is not Docher Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, because otherwise it couldn't exist. It will require Tavon Milchama. It will require Milchama. I think there was another dynamic also involving Rav Shach and the general Haredi approach, and that involved the historic reluctance of Haredim to serve in the military. So from that perspective, it seems almost rancorous to be demanding sovereignty and defense of these areas on the one hand, which would require a military effort, and on the other hand, say, we're not going to serve and let others fight that battle. So I think the reluctance to serve in the military engendered this sort of moderate approach towards a possession of the land of Israel. And to extend
that's quite a harsh framing, I think, you know, because you're saying that it's like being morally compromised, as it were. You know, I think the Haredim could also argue that, you know, on the one hand, they're not serving in the IDF for whichever reasons, and that's a long discussion, and now's probably not the time for it. But at the same time, you know, you have to make the right call on whether this is a value of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael or a value of, you know, a Torah value, that you have to make a decision on while being unclouded and unbiased by other factors. Meaning, I'm just pointing out your argument here
I certainly don't mean to be harsh, but I'm saying in the panoply of factors that are weighed in assessing a political approach to this most weighty issue, there's no doubt that has to play a role as well.
But it's a pretty harsh indictment. It's still a pretty harsh indictment. Let me ask you, even in this case, though, it could be argued that in every other peace deal that Israel has entered into, there's been a land concession. And specifically in this deal, in this normalization of relations, this is a precedent, meaning there's an Arab country that's normalizing relations with Israel without any land concession, and maybe this is actually a new precedent that will enable us to also broker a new kind of relationship concerning the Palestinians, that in the past it's always been about land for peace, and here, we can make peace without giving away any land. Maybe that's a different aspect or a different perspective to look at this?
I think that the Emiratis, of course, have no territorial claims on any part of the land of Israel. So it's a very easy concession for them to make. It will not necessarily imply that any future dialogue between Israel and the Palestinians will throw the land for peace formula out the window, because there you have two nations, or one nation and one entity, involved in among other things, a territorial dispute. So I go back to the notion of the fig leaf that I mentioned earlier, that the Emiratis did this just to demonstrate their bona fides to the rest of the Arab world. But that being done, if indeed Oman or Bahrain or Sudan want to enter into a similar treaty with Israel, there's going to be an expectation that there be some concession as well to them, because they need to show their bona fides as well. And what's going to happen? How will that take place? Because, again, there's no natural area of dispute between Oman and Bahrain and even Sudan.
Right.
Between those countries and Israel.
Fair enough. I grant that. Yeah, let me ask you another, and I think this goes back to the key issue here of the value of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael and applying sovereignty. These areas are largely areas that are inhabited by so-called Palestinians, people who are not members of the Jewish nation. I think that the one understanding, at the very least, of the Haredi approach is that the very fact that the State of Israel has sovereignty over these areas isn't an explicit Torah value. This is not called Yishuv Eretz Yisrael because it doesn't necessarily mean that more Jews will be living there. It's sovereignty per se, meaning there's something official about applying Israeli law, but Israeli law isn't Torah law, and the fact that we have sovereignty doesn't mean there'll be more Yidden living there. So maybe that's a more kind of generous attitude towards the Haredi approach. My question to you would be, How can we decide, or how can we be sure that the very concept of annexation or applying sovereignty is considered the Torah value of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael?
Well, the Ramban mentions in the Sefer Mitzvos Shashochach Oson Harav, Mitzvos the Rambam did not count.
Right.
Of course, Ramban famously counts Yishuv Eretz Yisrael as one of them, and he says the mitzvah is not to leave any part of the land of Israel in the hands, in the possession of any nation. So clearly, according to the Ramban, there is an interest, in fact, an element of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael is sovereignty over the land of Israel, and not simply dwelling there. But I have to make an additional point in response to what you said. There are vast the swaths of territory in Judea Samaria that are unsettled by Jews. But much of that is because of the hesitation of Israeli governments going back to the Six-Day War to allow Jews to live there. I always marvel at people who look at the Jewish community in Hebron, Eretz Yisrael, for example, and say, well, there are less than 1,000 people there living amongst over 100,000 Arabs. But there are less than 1,000 people living there because the government has severely restricted Jewish settlement in Hebron going back to 1970. So you have these limitations placed, and then the detractors will say, well, there's nobody living there. But if you remove the restrictions, then there'd be greater settlement, not just in Hebron, which is a more limited area, but across much wider expanses of Judea Samaria. And in fact, we both know that one of the beneficiaries of the settlement movement, even though they don't have the stereotypical image of the settler, is the Haredi, whether it's in Beit Ari Elit or Kiryat Sefer.
Technically, they are a part of the settlement movement, but I think in terms of their own self-identity, their self-understanding, they don't often perceive themselves as being a part of it, if you know what I mean. They're kind of passive participants.
Right. In terms of Hashkafa, they are not necessarily a part of the Dati Lumi, Gush Emunim, old Gush Emunim crowd. However, as you know, if you would speak to them, those who live in these areas, they would be indistinguishable from diehard settlers who would say, I'm not leaving, this is my home, this is Eretz Yisrael. They love it as much as any kippah sruga-wearing Israeli. And they see it as embodying the holiness of the land of Israel.
Yeah, this is very true. Let me end with the following question, and this is, how far would you be prepared to take this? Meaning, your approach has been that, well, Yeshiva Eretz Yisrael is doiche pikuach nefesh, and, you know, in this case, we shouldn't be compromising our core values of Torah, of Yeshiva Eretz Yisrael, of sovereignty over all areas of the state of Israel. So should we be really going towards applying that sovereignty, applying annexation, even at the cost of, you know, severely damaging our international influence, yeah, or international treaties with other countries, at the threat, of course, of boycott and divestment and so on, which again, if you will say, well, you go all the way, it's doiche pekuach nefesh, so it's certainly doiche all of these other factors. I mean, how far do you take this?
It has to be done with chachma. And chachma means exploiting opportunities that present themselves, especially when there's a favorable international environment. Now, look, I'm an American citizen. I've just recently left America, and I know how much Israelis do and should value the alliance between Israel and the United States. But that being said, I would never hold hostage Israel's policy interests to an American veto, which now the prime minister seems to be glorifying in. Every nation has its own sovereign interests and must act upon it. There should be a symmetry. There is always a symmetry of interest between America and Israel without there necessarily being an identity of interest. That can't be. So it has to be done with chachma. I think others have mentioned this also in the last few weeks. The American president now is so favorably disposed to Israel, and especially in the midst of an election campaign where he's touting his support for Israel as one of his major achievements, now would have been an ideal time to proclaim the extension of Israeli law to these areas. Such a time may not repeat itself again. And I think, again, it's not as dramatic as 1948, but if we recall properly, David Ben-Gurion was also under tremendous pressure from the American government and from the world community not to declare sovereignty and independence in May 1948. And nonetheless, it was a close vote in the cabinet when they decided what to do. But nonetheless, it was an act of tremendous courage, defying the world consensus and the American recommendations, because as Ben-Gurion thought, if we don't take advantage of this opportunity now, who knows when it's going to come again? And I think that's what I mean by chachma. We have to know when the international environment, as well as the domestic environment, is favorably disposed to it, act willfully and expeditiously, and move Jewish destiny forward.
Rabbi Pruzansky, thank you very much. Illuminating as always, and insightful, and not pashut. You know, one cannot always envy the statesmen who are in a position to make such decisions. And you know, history will be the arbiter, will be the judge. But,
no doubt about it. It's not simple, yeah, to be a diplomat. It does involve compromises and waiting. But like I said, it requires above all chokhmah.
Yishar koach, Gadol. Thank you very much for being with us. And I really look forward to the next time. Yishar koach. Thank you and all the best.
It's been a pleasure. Be well.
Thank you very much. With us today to discuss the strategic and the geopolitical implications of this historic accord between Israel and the Emirates is David Weinberg. David Weinberg, apart from being a close friend, is vice president of the Jerusalem Institute for Strategy and Security. He's also a diplomatic columnist for the Jerusalem Post and for Yisrael Hayom, alongside publishing in many other platforms. So, David, really thank you very, very much for being with us today. And maybe I'll open up with a kind of general question, and that is, many of us have heard about this historic accord, this normalization of relations between Israel and the United Arab Emirates. Is this good? Is this good for the Jews, good for the world? Give us the different sides of and the different kind of implications, the central implications of this agreement. How should we be looking at this?
I'm happy to do so, Rabbi Pfeffer. Glad to be on with you. This is not a small matter. The UAE-Israel Accord is a significant step on a 100-plus year march towards legitimizing the idea of a Jewish state in the Middle East. It is an ideological big bang in Arab-Israel relations. It breaks 72 years of refusal by the 19 Arab states that don't have any border with Israel to come to terms with Israel, and specifically not to be held back any longer by never-ending Palestinian rejectionism. Now, let's take a step back for a moment and consider this latest development in the context of the Trump administration's plan to transform Middle East peacemaking. The Trump plan of last year
Do you think this was part of the original plan of Donald Trump's regional peacemaking, or did this suddenly come up as an opportunity?
No, this did not suddenly come up as an opportunity. The Trump plan unleashed a regional dynamic whereby Arab states can move towards open partnership with Israel on a wide range of issues. Now, Israel has had deepening relations with the Emirates for over a decade. There are 200 Israeli companies already doing business in Abu Dhabi and Dubai in the fields of technology, agricultural, defense, and so on. But what this agreement says is that Israel can't be held hostage to never-ending Palestinian vetoes, and nor should the Sunni Arab world need to be held back by the self-immolating Palestinian national movement. Remember, there were three Arab ambassadors at the White House last year when the Trump plan was unveiled, and that includes the ambassador of the United Arab Emirates. And the American plan was a way of forcing everybody to face the fact that Israel cannot be expected to freeze development of its strategic and historic heartland while waiting endlessly for a peaceful and democratic Palestinian political culture to emerge miraculously. Now, there are, of course, other forces that are driving Israel and the Gulf states together, the threats from Iran and from radical Islam, alongside a desire to advance into the 21st century and benefit from Israeli technological advances. And now the UAE is showing the way. This is a creates new strategic alliances, both in the Persian Gulf and in the Eastern Mediterranean.
Right. So, I mean, you said that this breaks a 100-plus year-long kind of stall, if you want, in terms of Israel's relations with the Arab countries. But, I mean, Israel does already have peace treaties with Egypt, with Jordan. Why is this so much more significant? Why did this take us into a kind of a different place, given that we're already in peaceful relations? We have embassies with Egypt and Jordan already.
Egypt and Jordan had borders with Israel and border disputes with Israel. What was holding back all the other 19 Arab members of the Arab League who have no border disputes with Israel from normalizing their relations with Israel? The excuse always was, you got to settle with the Palestinians first before we can enter relations with Israel. And this UAA decision is a slap in the face to the Palestinians, to the Israeli left to some degree, and even more importantly, to the two major non-Arab hegemonic powers in the region, which is Shiite Iran and the Muslim Brotherhood-led regime in Turkey. It's also an enormous slap in the face to the international BDS movement, which has long called for, you know, boycotts of Israel, sanctions against Israel, divestment from Israel. The UAE is saying, boycott Israel? What are you talking about? We want to trade with Israel. We view Israel as an important part of the Middle East. Now, if you take this one level up, this also has global strategic significance. The Emiratis see Israel as an important strategic anchor in a region where, at a time when the United States, under President Obama, and to a certain extent also under President Trump, has been withdrawing from the region. And the Russians have been throwing their weight around and allowing the Iranians and the Turks to do so as well. Gulf states are searching for new strategic anchors in the region. And the one major power in the region that's not going to go anywhere, that's not going to leave, that's not going to turn its attentions to Asia or turn into dealing with its internal problems and to forsake the Middle East is, of course, Israel. So this agreement helps solidify, as I said earlier, new strategic alliances in the Persian Gulf, also new strategic alliances in the Eastern Mediterranean, where the Turks are throwing their weight around. The UAE is backing the anti-Turkish forces in the ongoing civil war in Libya. So it finds Israel and the UAE and Egypt on one side and Turks and the Iranians on the other. And this has broader strategic significance. It could, of course, be win-win for the Palestinians, too, if they were willing to...
If they get their act together, but they're not going
to
do that.
Yeah, if they were willing to engage. You have to remember, just these last 2 months, the Palestinian Authority rejected two plane loads full of coronavirus aid from the United Arab Emirates. So the Emirates say, you know, you're that stupid, you're that recalcitrant, you're that backwards. We're moving on.
And what about the price tag? Let's speak a little bit about the price that Israel is paying for this, and that is the effective cancellation of the annexation plan. Would you say that's a fair price to be paying for this arrangement, for this deal?
Had there been a real opportunity now to apply Israeli sovereignty to significant parts of Judea and Samaria, my answer would be no. This is not a fair price to pay. Israel should not be trading away the coin of sovereignty for agreements with Gulf states. But the fact is that what Netanyahu is getting here is a face-saving, significant reward for not doing something that he wasn't going to be able to do anyway in the current political diplomatic context, meaning that given the fact that Trump is perhaps in the final months of his presidency and a Democratic administration may be entering the White House in January, and the Democrats have made it absolutely clear that they would not recognize any application of Israeli sovereignty to Judea and Samaria. Given the fact that Netanyahu did not have support in his own national unity government for a sovereignty move of any significant size, given the fact that Netanyahu did not have support in much of the settlement community for the type of sovereignty application that was being talked about. As I say, given all those things, he wasn't going to be able to do this now. And therefore, the deal with the Saudis in some way gets him out of a difficult situation. I would like to believe, although I'm not sure I do, that an opportunity may come a year from now or 4 years from now or 5 years from now to implement those planks in the Trump plan that allow Israel to apply sovereignty to significant parts of Judea and Samaria. I'm not sure that the political constellation will come again so quickly.
Mm-hmm. And do you think that Israel's internal stability will be badly affected by this because of, let's say, the people on the right, which is a large block of Netanyahu supporters that are feeling, I guess, disillusioned, even betrayed by Netanyahu? Do you think that that will have a severe effect on the current stability of Israel, which might also have a broader effect on this entire kind of development in terms of Middle East, you know, the Middle East balance of power? Do you think that is that something that might play out, or you think this is going to pass quietly on an internal level?
I think your latter assessment is more accurate. It's wishful thinking on the part of the ideological right in Israel to believe that there's going to be an entire groundswell of opinion against Netanyahu for putting aside the sovereignty bid and preferring this diplomatic deal with the Gulfies. Now, that's not the case. For better or for worse, the hardcore ideological settlement sector in Israeli politics is worth maybe two seats, so maybe two seats will move from Likud to Yamina. That's the party headed by Naftali Bennett and Ayelet Shaked. But I don't think this is going to. This is a development that's going to break support for Netanyahu in Israeli politics. As I said, I think most people realize that the sovereignty move had become bogged down in regional and international politics, and this was not something that Netanyahu was going to be able to do now in the current political and diplomatic context. It is important for Netanyahu to continue saying that he's committed to moving in this direction. Maybe if he survives in Israeli politics and Trump wins re-election, there will be another opportunity, let's say a year from now, but that's all speculation.
Mm-hmm. So let me ask you this another question, and this this takes us back to 1979. Israel had very good relations with Iran, and those relations included both economic cooperation and also military cooperation and intelligence cooperation, meaning we had close relations. But 1979, you know, the regime turned, and the Iranian Revolution ultimately meant that all of that cooperation backfired against Israel in the most direct way, because all of that military assistance and intelligence cooperation was now at the hands of a state that had become Israel's enemy overnight, as it were, and this turned against them. It backfired on them. Would you say that there should be a concern concerning this new kind of brokering, this new opening up of the Gulf states and potentially other Arab states to cooperation with Israel? Could this also backfire in a similar way to what happened in Iran? Or are we confident here that whatever weapons, I know that there's this deal of giving F-35s or selling F-35s to the Emirates. Should we be concerned about all of this? Or this is a different story altogether, and it doesn't entail those concerns?
There's actually a professional technical term for what you're talking about. It's called blowback, meaning that weapons sold to a regional partner, in this case perhaps the United States selling advanced weapon platforms to the Emiratis, as they have done with the Saudis for years, could blow back against the United States or on Israel if there's a regime change in one of these countries. The danger is less significant than one might imagine. I mean, the same argument that you've just made about Israel's longstanding intelligence and defense relationship with the Shah of Iran right through the late 1970s. The same is true as also of the Turks. Israel had an outstanding relationship with the Turkish military as late as the 1990s until the AKP party headed by Erdogan, which is essentially a radical Islamist party, came to power, and then Turkey has now become one of the most hostile and viciously anti-Israel and anti-Semitic countries in the region. And Turkey is far more powerful than the United Arab Emirates will ever be. It's much closer to us. It's much larger. It's a NATO member. It has an enormous navy that is seeking to control the entire Eastern Mediterranean. So if we have concerns about Western weaponry falling into the hands of bad actors in the region, I would put Turkey at the top of my list of what to be worried about, not the United Arab Emirates. There have been many previous instances in which the United States has sold advanced weapon platforms to Arab countries in the region over and above Israel's objections, going all the way back to the sale of the AWACS to the Saudis in the early 1980s. There is an American law which requires Congress to certify that whatever weapon sales are made to countries in the Middle East, Israel is maintaining its qualitative military edge, QME, qualitative military edge. And I assume that there'll be a process here as well where Congress will work to ensure that the administration, whatever administration, maintains Israel's qualitative military edge, which means, for example, that if the F-35 advanced fighter is sold at some point to the Emiratis or to the Saudis, it's not going to be the same platform that Israel's already received. It will be a somewhat downgraded platform. It will be a platform that's locked and loaded where the Emiratis or the Saudis cannot make any changes, unlike the F-35s, which Israel has received, which are basically stripped bare, and Israel loads its own advanced avionics and weapon systems to these planes with American concurrence and cooperation. So there are ways of ensuring that Israel maintains its qualitative military edge, even if the Trump administration or next U.S. administration sells advanced weapon platforms to the Emiratis. And that's a process that would take 10 to 15 years, and Israel knows how to adjust.
And to navigate that. What about the effect, if any, on all of the different terrorist groups? You know, we've spoken about different countries around the world, but we also know that a lot of the more immediate threats, and this is not a national security threat in the deep sense, but it's a nuisance. And it can be a significant nuisance. I'm talking about, organizations like Hamas, like the Jihad, Hezbollah, perhaps, which is obviously related to Iran, but also further out, the organizations in Yemen and so on, all of these terror groups. How do you think that this development could influence the threat or otherwise from these terror groups that, you know, that are obviously a significant, you know, a significant, not a global player, but still a significant actor in the region?
The greatest tailwind behind groups like ISIS and Al-Qaeda, which are Sunni terrorist groups, Hamas as well, Hezbollah, which is a Shiite terrorist group that is more than a group, it's actually a government that controls Lebanon today. The greatest tailwind behind all these bad actors is Iran. And the real danger from a Western grand strategic perspective and Israeli perspective is that the Iranians complete what they call their Shiite arc, controlling an arc of territories that runs in a span directly from the Persian Gulf through Iraq, Syria and Lebanon to the Mediterranean, and from there projecting power into the Mediterranean and beyond. That's what the Iranians are after. They pick and choose different militias, different armies to help them capture and control different parts of that arc. That's why Iran for at some point was allied with the West in fighting Al-Qaeda, fighting ISIS in Iraq because it wanted the ISIS-controlled territories, which eventually have become Iranian-controlled zones in northern Iraq. That's the real danger. And if the Iranian march towards regional hegemony is not even more significantly checked, not just by Israel, which is really the only actor fighting the Iranians in the region now, but also by American leadership, that's the long-term threat faced by Israel, by Sunni states in the region, and ultimately by European countries and America itself. The American commanders in the region understand that. That's why the American military has been so uncomfortable with the repeated withdrawals, first ordered by Obama and by Trump, withdrawals of American troops in the region. There's really only one significant American ground force left in the Middle East. That's a small contingent that holds a triangle between Jordan, Syria, and Iraq along a major highway that would complete this that Shiite arc that I was talking about. And, of course, there are American naval troops and air bases in Saudi Arabia and the Persian Gulf. But if America continues to withdraw, we can expect a resurgence of terrorist activity from the groups we've discussed.
Of those groups. So, but what you're saying then is that this agreement, insofar as it weakens Iran, then that weakens also these other terrorist actors who are either funded by or acting on behalf of Iran, too. How do you think Iran will react to this? I mean, how is this going to play out?
Well, to begin with, the Iranians are doing three things. Number one, the Iranians are biding their time, meaning they're waiting to see what the result of the American presidential elections in November will be. They, of course, are hoping that Trump will be tossed out of office, and the Democrats who've all talked about re-entering the JCPOA, the nuclear diplomatic deal that President Obama reached with them, that they'll renegotiate that deal somehow, American sanctions against Iranian oil exports and weapons developments will be dropped, and the Iranians will breathe easier in the region. So the first thing they're doing is they're waiting. Second of all, the Iranians are actively working to ensure that additional Arab countries in the region don't take the American bait and move to more open relations with Israel. So there's plenty of Iranian pressure on some of the countries we discussed beforehand, like Bahrain, Oman, and Morocco, not to go in the direction that the Emiratis have gone. And third of all, the Iranians are actively engaged in subversion in the region. They are building their forward presence against Israel through a whole series of Shiite militias, including Hezbollah, in southern Syria, under the protective air cover of the Russian army, which controls the air
and all across the
region now.
And now with the support of China also now, I don't know how China will be involved militarily, but at least it's probably some kind of a moral boost or a internationally significant boost in a geopolitical sense.
It certainly helps the Iranians survive continued Western sanctions and boycotts of their oil industry. The Chinese, as you say, are not engaging militarily in the region, although they are building naval bases, off the coast of Djibouti, taking strategic placements in around the Horn of Africa, and they're willing to buy any oil that the Iranians can ship out of the Persian Gulf.
Mm-hmm.
They're willing to trade with Iran in additional fields such as the steel industry, which is very important to them. So the Chinese are not, certainly as long as they're engaged in a trade war with the United States, they aren't going to be cooperating in American-led sanctions against Iran, and that, of course, is a problem.
Well, this has been very illuminating, so thank you very much. Just maybe to finish off, do you think that this is going to have a domino effect with these additional Arab nations, the Gulf states, maybe first of all, maybe even Saudi Arabia, which obviously would be the biggest fish in the region. Do you expect that to happen in the short-term, mid-term future?
I'm hopeful that this trend will continue and there will be additional Sunni Arab states announcing closer ties to Israel. It all depends on one thing. It depends on the buildup, the continuing buildup of the perception in the region that Israel is a strong, winning state with the best ties of any country in the world with Washington. Any drawdown in those perceptions works against Israel, works against Western interests in the region, and will cut back the drive in the region to partner with Israel. The close ties between the Netanyahu administration in Israel and the Trump administration in Washington, whatever else you may think of Trump, President Trump, and the Trump administration, those close ties create the perception of strategic importance and power for Israel. Mm-hmm. And the Gulf states seek to bandwagon in the region with those powers that are successful, especially as they face the continuing threats from hegemonic Iran and radical Islam.
What you're saying, so among other things, what you're saying is that the upcoming election could be very significant in this sense. You would be telling our listeners, if you care about Israel, vote Trump.
I never said any such thing, but I would hope. It is certainly critical. Let's put it this way. It is certainly critical that there be, as much as possible, continuity and stability in American policy towards the Middle East. Unfortunately, American Middle East policy and America-Israel relations have become a partisan issue in American politics, and that holds great dangers for Israel security.
David Weinberg, thank you very, very much for joining us. It's been illuminating and important. So, and I look forward to next time.
Thank you. Everybody should stay safe, be healthy, and pray for the peace of Jerusalem.
Amen. 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 Thank you very much. All the very best.
Bye-bye.